You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, everybody. So we're going to go ahead and get started. So we're going to ask everyone if they could take their seats. So I guess everyone's anticipating a very engaging and what I believe will be a very robust conversation this evening. I want to first thank everybody for coming out on behalf of the Ann Beeson, Executive Director of U.S. Programs, Open Society Foundation's U.S. Programs, and also on behalf of Sean Dove, the campaign's manager for the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. When we were conceiving this event, we had very high hopes because, for myself personally, because I saw Kathy Cohen in Chicago, I think maybe back in June. And for some of those who may not know, I went to Yale, but I wasn't one of the privileged students to be in Kathy's class. I wasn't smart enough to be in Kathy's class. So I actually, I told Kathy when I saw that, she said, in our conversation, she said she was going to be working on a book. And I said, what was the title of the book? And she said, Democracy Remix, Black Youth and the Future of American Politics. I said, well, this is my chance to actually sit in one of her classes and invite her to actually present her book this evening. And I had no idea how much of a how it would turn out with the panelists who we also thank for coming out this evening. But before we start, we usually have a lot of things that we want to engage with, but this event wouldn't be possible. I always feel like I'm at the VMAs or the Oscars. There's like the list of people you need to thank. And so before I do that, though, before I get into why we're here this evening, I want to first thank up front our co-partner in justice, not crime, the Democracy and Power Fund, who has been, this is a second event we've hosted with them, I believe, in the last month, less than a month, or maybe a little bit over a month, that we've hosted with them. So I just want to invite their program officer, one of their program officers, Cristobal, Josh, Alex, to come up and just give a little bit of background on the Democracy and Power Fund.
Thanks, Rashid, and again, thanks to all of you for coming out tonight, and especially thanks to our esteemed panelists. We are extremely happy at the Democracy and Power Fund to be able to co-host these events with CBMA, mostly because of the great food that we've got back there, but also because we learned so very much. The Democracy and Power Fund aims to increase public participation, thereby building power in the communities that we prioritize. And we do that using a range of strategies, three of which are implicated by tonight's panel, including grassroots organizing, voter engagement, and youth engagement. And our team and others here at OSI are extremely excited about tonight's panel. We're excited to learn about the amazing work that the panelists are doing, some of which we are lucky enough to be able to support. We're also hopeful that we'll hear about the challenges in the field and what some of the opportunities in the field are. We know here at OSI from our own scans of the field that this particular area is extremely under-resourced. And so we want to hear from you, from our panelists, about how we as funders across the landscape can do a better job of supporting the important work that needs to be done among youth engagement and communities of color, particularly the African-American community, the work that needs to get done to support African-American-led organizations, and of course, civic engagement. Thank you.
So I'll get into trouble because Sean's in the back, Sean Dove, wave. I also want to wish him a pre-happy birthday. His birthday is on Saturday. So let's all wish him a happy birthday. I don't get to really shout him out too often in public, so I'm happy to do so. But just really quickly, the Campaign for Black Male Achievement is a multi-year initiative here at the foundation focusing on improving the positive life outcomes of African American males. And one of the things that Sean has been very very strong in doing and really voicing is really sustain the campaign and make sure the campaign continues on beyond the initial 3 years. So I'm happy to announce that that has happened, that we are going to be a focus on improving the life outcomes of black men and boys. And so the areas in which we're focused on is educational equity, increasing work opportunities, and also looking to improve family structures. And the other areas that we've been using as our pillar is really strengthening the field. We're really focusing on building capacity for organizations, as well as the area that is really crucial for us is strategic communications and using arts and culture as a tool to advance a conversation beyond those that we've already have had. So without much ado and without me talking too much, I want to introduce this evening a spoken word artist by the name of Breon Bain, who some of you may know. He's the co-founder of an arts and culture organization called Blackouts Arts Collective. They've been committed. I believe I met Breon many years ago. I'm not trying to give my age away because I'm still trying to be in that young person range. But I was happy actually when I saw Kathy use her studies and she still had 35, 36 up there, 37, trying to stay young. But Breon and I go way back when I used to work with the Prison Moratorium Project. And I just want to introduce him because his work has been phenomenal. We actually reconnected at the Creative Change, which our colleague Tim Dorsey and Ann Beeson in office were out there reconnecting and doing some great work. So I'm going to ask Breon to come up. And the reason that we do this is so often there's a disconnect between communications, arts and culture, and what we're trying to do in terms of trying to promote change as a foundations or foundations. And what we really want to do is bridge those things. And so at our events, we're always committed to trying to include a segment that is committed to arts and culture. So don't know what Breon's got to do, but I'm going to assume it's going to be great. So I'm going to call him up and ask him to present. I'm not sure, Breon, do you need a free mic or? Okay.
Thank you.
Sit right back. I am here at the tale of an untold trip. Forest, a boy and old name Ship. The mate was a mighty racist man, I'm sure. Five slave traders set sail that day on a transatlantic tour. On a transatlantic tour. Was up when they had enough. That old slave ship was tossed. If not for the courage of a fearless few, with freedom would be lost. With freedom would be washed down upon the shore of this uncharted Caribbean island. And we killed the skipper too, cut off the millionaire and him one. Shot the movie star, blah, 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 Professor Anne Marion, here on Liberation. Thank you. It's a blessing to be here. Thank you, Ashi. Thank you. Round of applause for everybody who helped to organize. And my elders in the room, my ancestors, I wanted to start off with that. I see my people from Shell that I had a hug to. And I wanted to start off with this profound piece of popular culture because I think it's relevant. A lot of folks who are young people, you know, I was watching that. I know some of y'all was home. But I wrote this remix of, I was upset, all right? So I wrote this, but I think the deeper meaning which came revealed to me after a conversation I had with my Before they get on the ship, y'all know who the characters are, right? Who's the most powerful person before they get on the ship? The millionaire. Why the millionaire? Real quick. We're going to fly through this. Because all his money counts. His money enables him to have a certain amount of power, right? Right? One kind of power. They get on the ship, though, right? And they're on the ship, and the ship starts to shake and starts to rock, and all of a sudden, who becomes the most powerful person? The skipper, the captain. Why? Because he knows what to do on the ship, right? The millionaire's, all his money bags, y'all saw Titanic, right? That's no longer making him powerful. We might have to throw his ass off the ship if he tries to hold on to his money, right? That doesn't help him there. Now when the ship crashes,
Who becomes the most powerful person on the ship? The professor. Why? He has knowledge. He knows how to make radios out of coconuts. The professor. You can't do that, right? You know? So the professor has all this power all of a sudden. When the millionaire, not so much. The movie star, we don't care how famous you are. We need some water. You need to go fetch that water right now, all right? That's what we're doing, all right? So this is one of the stories we use with the young brothers at Rikers Island, where I've taught for several years in prisons around the country, to bring in this important story, which validates some of the power that they walk sometimes into Rikers with. You know, young folks in public schools walk into the classroom with. And oftentimes, because we don't recognize the power of multiple literacies and multiple intelligences, we write them off as being ignorant, being illiterate, right? And we all have literacies. We just have different kinds of literacies. And when we validate and understand those, we can bridge the gap between the literacies and the codes of power within these institutions and folks who are generally marginalized and blocked out of those institutions. So I wanted to start with that to get to that point. I'm going to share one more piece to get us in this energy of just openness and creativity that has fueled our movement since the beginning of time. And this piece is a part of this one-man show that I've been touring, which is such a misnomer when you have a band and a live DJ. It's like so many people on stage, right? But it's my story of being wrongfully, racially profiled and wrongfully incarcerated for a short period of time. And it weaves in the story of a friend of mine who's been on death row. He's been on death row at 17, who's been locked up for the last 18 years. And it's a piece that I used to open up that show. And I want to use, is this one on? Yeah. Okay. There we go. So the story goes, beauty and ugliness are walking down the street one day. Ugliness says to beauty, let's go take a swim. So the two disrobe. They dive into the water and begin to swim around underwater. After a while, ugliness comes up out of the water, decides to leave. So she goes back to shore and puts on the fine garments that beauty left behind. A little while later, beauty comes up. She was swimming around looking for Nemo, whatever she was doing. She comes up out of the water and, being all by herself and slightly embarrassed in her nakedness, decides to do what? Yes, my man is on point. Put on the tattered rags that ugliness left behind. All right? And to this day, there are still those who see the one and mistake her for the other. There are those who see ugliness walking around in beauty's fine garments, DKNY, Dolce & Gabbana, Louis Vuitton. And I'm not even talking about clothes, right? And we think we're looking at who? Call and response, y'all. Y'all know the tradition. All right. But then there's other folks who see ugliness or see beauty walking around in these old tattered rags, and they're confused. They think they're looking at who? Ugliness. Okay, but there are those of us in this room today, and this is what this panel, this conversation, discussion is going to be about. There are those of us who see past the surfaces of things. There are those of us who know that every black man in baggy pants ain't a criminal, despite subliminal media messages to the contrary. Message telling you not to come near me. Message telling you that you should fear me when you steer me in the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, limb for a limb, life for a life. Got you looking at me like I got nothing better to do than to rob you of your life for the butcher knife or to rape your ugly wife. But things are often not what they seem. You see, ignorance rocks dreadlocks sometimes. And self-hate slaps head wraps around relaxed naps so you can't see what's on her mind. Intellect gets out of bat to protect her neck and get God's back, leaving religions bludgeoned to death by the dozen for pretending to be spirituality when most can't even be as close as distant cousins. Cause in spite of the reality, spirituality is relative. Religion and spirituality are not necessarily relatives, though they often seem related. Things are often not what they seem. Things fall apart and pulled apart by what? Seems. Things fall apart when pulled apart by what seems, because what seems is something our senses dream, and it takes more than common sense to make sense of the common dream, and some dreams only youth can hear. For as age turns time's pages, some elders lose their ears to their ears and forget their ears, failing to fulfill fantasies that will forever disappear, but we can't let their fantasies disappear. We can't let our imagination disappear, because if we do, then what the hell on earth are we doing here? Been to earth and not to hell, but if I had been there, I imagine it'd be a nation with no imagination, and I imagine it'd be a nation where everybody's nationality was reality, and I imagine in this image of a nation, in my imagination, if everybody fell to hell, we'd all be forced to keep it real. to keep it real, real, to keep it real, real, real. And that third reel is like a third rail that won't let imagination's lungs do anything but fail. And I'm still waiting for mine to exhale, because reality, reality, somehow was hypnotized everybody and kidnapped creativity. Got niggas thinking they can only be what they see. Got sisters thinking they can only be what they see. Or we don't have to only be what eyes can see. So you can keep it real if you want to keep it real. I ain't trying to keep shit real. Reality is killing me. I'd rather be swimming in a fantasy or in a metaphorist planting my poetry or stirring piping hot pots of possibility, possibility, possibility. Tea with honey, please, because my honey bees, my honey bee, not like the insect, but like existence bee, just letting me be who I be, so I can be, and she can be, and we can be, all we can be, and we can all be free, and we can all be free, if we could just set free what it means to be or not to be, because existence should not be shackled by any one word or definition. And existence should not be shackled by anyone's words or definitions. Definitions are for definers, not for the defined. Definitions are for definers, not for the divine. And definitions definitely ain't divine. You can't define anything divine with any definition you can find. But what you can't find is a long line of definers who've definitively lost their mind and trying to define my black behind since before the beginning of time. Since I sold earth solid gold and told her sun to shine and made the moon swoon with the swig of her own moonshine. She still can't walk a straight line anymore. She stumbles in circular motion, shaking even the ocean's floor back and forth and forth and back. She gets so dizzy that she sees black. She gets so dizzy everything goes black. And once you go black, you never go word. Once you go blackward, you never go backward. You only go blackward. And the blackest word I ever heard was we. So I turn it upside down, use it interchangeably with me, myself, and I. Me, myself, and I. Me, myself, and I. Me, myself, I like to max. Stick up, kids is out to tax. Dizzy Gillespie played the... Actually, he played trumpet. But that's exactly what I mean. Things are often not what they seem. Thank you.
Okay, I'm hyped now, so. All right, let me get this right. So I want to thank Breon for blessing the mic and opening it up for us. And so what I'm going to do is, as I said, this is like the VMAs. No one does this by themselves. So I just want to go through a list of individuals and just thank them for helping us make this event a successful event tonight, getting this together. I want to first thank the events team, Karen and Marissa, for all their work that they always do. Obviously, the DMP team, Bill, Nashe, Patricia, Cristobal, and also obviously the panelists themselves. And finally, for some of those who came here earlier, you were able to pick up a few free copies of the book. And I just want to thank Oxford University Press and others for working with us to get those here and assisting us. And most importantly, I want to thank Haley Roberts in the back, who's our program associate. She's been working tirelessly to kind of ensure that tonight's event will be successful. And alongside with her is Joseph Moffitt on our administrative team, and then also the legal team of Grace, Dana, and Sarah. So with that said, I had a lot of things I wanted to say, but I think I'm going to go right into trying to introduce the panel, because I think you'd rather hear from them than from me. So I wanted to start off, and oh, I forgot one last thing. I have to thank my fiance for showing up this evening. That's the most important thank you, because otherwise I gotta go home and when I said that Sean was having his birthday, I forgot to mention he's turning 35, so. I could joke too. Okay, so I'm going to start off with introducing our panel, and I'm going to start off with, if they will sit, is Erin Bird. She's from North Carolina, where she serves as the Civic Engagement Coordinator for an organization called Blueprint North Carolina. Erin's work is focused on building capacity of nonprofits to do voter and civic engagement. She is also the Political Action Chair for the North Carolina State Conference of Branches of the NAACP. Prior to joining Blueprint in February 2007, Aaron's work included leading youth civic engagement projects that resulted in the passage of a bill increasing the minimum wage in North Carolina. She's also currently serves as an advisor for a local organization in North Carolina that works with teens. Aaron, please welcome Aaron. Next, I'm going to invite Alicia Morgan, who's, from what I understand, is a native Floridian as well as our moderator this evening. But for the last 8 years, she has served as a member of the Georgia House of Representatives from the metro Atlanta area. In fact, Alicia made history in November 2002 when she became the first African-American to serve in the Georgia legislature. In addition to her public service as an elected representative, Alicia is the membership manager of the Young Elected Officials Network, which is a grantee partner of the Democracy and Power Fund, and I believe a number of fronts here. We all co-funded the YEL Network, which is a project of and that supports elected officials under the age of 35 from across the country and currently has more than 500 members. So thank you. Welcome, Alicia. Next, I would like to ask Biko Baker, who hails from Milwaukee on the map, and is the executive director of the League of Young Voters, which works to empower young people nationwide to participate in the democratic process and create progressive political change on the local, state, and national levels. It is unique in that its primary focus is on non-college youth and youth from low-income communities and communities of color. Biko is nationally recognized young leader and cultural artist, and he's a writer, source. He's done so much, so welcome, Biko. The next person is Monifa Bendele. She's a native New Yorker, also a friend of mine from way, 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 way back. She serves as a senior program and outreach manager for the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, which is the home of the Black Youth Vote Project, an experienced organizer. Prior to joining the National Coalition, Monifa was communications director at Change the Game, where she engaged in innovative grassroots outreach and media strategies that targeted African Americans with a special emphasis on youth. So thank you, Monifa. And our next panelist is Edward James III, and he's a third-year student at the University of Chicago, where he majors in political science and comparative race and ethnic studies. At the University of Chicago, he has served as political chair for the Organization of Black Students and director of campus services. He also conducts research and blogs for the Black Youth Project. Thank you, Edward. So the next two people I'll introduce are our moderator and who I mentioned earlier, Kathy Cohen, Dr. Kathy Cohen, who is truly an honor to have both of these individuals on the panel with these panelists, because for those who know Thomasina, she has been a resource for a number of program officers here at OSI, and she's been very supportive in our own development, those who've just landed here, and being willing to answer questions. So Thomasina is a program officer with responsibility for the strategic development implementation of the Ford Foundation's initiative on promoting electoral reform, democratic participation. Her work encompasses issues related to the census, redistricting, and elections, and efforts to reform the rules governing participation through these systems to increase the opportunities for underserved populations to engage, enhance their collective political power, and attract more substantial investments into their communities. Over the course of the last 5 years, she has generated in excess of $40 million in grant investments. She is also an attorney who was previously managed a private practice in Miami and prior to joining the Ford Foundation. So if Thomasina will come up. And I also want to thank Thomasina, especially because I know how hard it is to leave South Beach and the beaches to come to New York. And that, lastly, as I mentioned, is Kathy Cohen. Yeah, come on. Who's, as I mentioned earlier, I know Kathy from Yale, but we never had opportunity to really connect while I was there. But but I heard great things about her. And as I said earlier, I recently reconnected with her and learned about what she's doing primarily around the Black Youth Project. And I wanted to have this opportunity to have her discuss her book this evening. And Kathy currently is a professor of political science and a former director of the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture at the University of Chicago. She is the author of The Boundaries of Blackness, AIDS, and the Breakdown of Black Politics. And Cohen currently serves as a co-director with Frederick Harris of a book series from Oxford University Press entitled Transgressing Boundaries, Studies in Black Politics and Black Communities. And one thing that I think is most important this evening that I just wanted to close before I open it up for Thomasina to facilitate is that while this is the Campaign for Black Male Achievement, we really see this as a community building and focus initiative. So while what you'll see on the panel, there are a number of women, and we really believe that part of this conversation, and I'm glad the title is Black Youth and not just Black Males, that we really want to have a robust and open conversation about the intersectionality of gender and race as it relates to this issue. So a lot of times people think you see Black male, you see achievement, you know, you don't think we're focusing on the inclusion of women, but we really see this as a building block to our overall success, is that the absence of the name of women does not mean they're not part of the conversation. So with that said, I'll open and pass it over to Thomasina, and thank you all for being here this evening.
Thank you very much, Rashid. I want to give a special thanks to Rashid and all of my colleagues here at OSI who honor me by asking me to play this role this evening to really celebrate the work that Kathy has been doing and is doing. Any opportunity I have to really celebrate her brilliance, I'm really happy to do that, as well as that of the young leaders who we have assembled here today, most of whom I've had an opportunity to work with through my work at Ford. We really do want this to be a conversation. I'm sure that in addition to Kathy and the panelists, a number of you in the audience also have some important things to contribute to this conversation. But just to get us started, I wanted to pose a question to Kathy. One of the things that struck me about the book, reading the first line, I mean literally the first line, in the acknowledgments, you talk about the fact that no one is able to write a book alone. And that, to me, sort of symbolizes the challenge before us in addressing this question of the plight of Black youth in this society, and particularly their role in American politics. It also struck for me the whole issue of relationship and what some might think of as linked fate. And I really want to appreciate Breon, too, for the very provocative way that he started this conversation and using the illustration of Gilligan's Island to talk about relationship and the role of various members of our society. The fact that all of our fates really are linked, whether we think about that on a conscious level or not. And one of the other, I thought, really interesting sort of overarching themes of the book, Kathy, is this question of the structural as well as the personal. The structural systemic challenges that Black youth face, as well as this whole question of professional responsibility that lots of people want to place more emphasis on. It's one of the areas that I think that we in philanthropy have a tendency to want to do an either-or kind of thing, regardless of what issue we're dealing with, and the failure to look at things systemically. So if you could just share with us a little bit at the beginning about what got you into the research and what your two or three biggest takeaways are and learnings on this journey of putting together the research and the book.
Okay, great. Can everybody hear me? Usually that is not a problem because I have a big mouth, they tell me. So before I answer your question, which were great questions, all five of them, so I appreciate that.
You know, I have a tendency to do that.
That's right. But I would expect nothing less from Thomasina. I also want to say some thank yous. I want to thank the folks at OSI, in particular Rashid and Haley, Patricia, for pulling this together, hosting this, and including a really amazing group of people to have what I hope will be a very important conversation. I so appreciate not only this event, but the work that you're doing, and I feel honored to be a part of that. I want to thank Thomasina, because the truth of the matter is that when you go to get your research funded and you go to a place like the Ford Foundation, most of the time there's no one there who really is that interested in some young black, well, I used to be young, sort of young, black professor who wants to do work on black youth. That's just the truth of the matter. And so walking into Ford, meeting Thomasina and having her understand the research and the importance of the research is just kind of a critical moment in seeing an institution being transformed. And I guess I just really want to thank you publicly for all that you've done for my work, for the importance of the work, and I think for lots of us up here. So thank you very much, Thomas.
Thank you.
I want to thank Breon. That was an amazing, spirit-filled, intellectually engaging and challenging set of pieces, and the perfect way, I think, to start this discussion. Okay, so now I think I'm supposed to answer your questions, right? So you're right. I had to go back and look very quickly at the acknowledgments, not because they don't mean something very deeply, but oftentimes they get lost a bit when you're writing a book. And it is a process of community. When you started your question, I thought you were going to say you were struck by the first sentence in the first chapter, which really is about my nephew. And so when I think about the kind of initial inspiration for the book, it was about watching a young man that I love deeply struggle in a world that seemed unfair. And I worried about his future and his life and his life trajectory. It was that simple, right? It was about my people. And what I came to learn as I talked with him and talked with his friends is that his story really was a very familiar story to many black families, not just poor black families, but also middle-class black families and some upper-class black families, about what was happening to young black people in the political domain and actually the social and physical domain at this particular moment. What happened to a life trajectory that we expected would be much better than their grandparents and their aunts and uncles, and looked actually much dimmer in many cases. And so the book is a process of hearing their stories, Terry's stories, his friends, building different methodological approaches to hear greater numbers of young people, and for all of those voices, I think, to tell hopefully what is a kind of nuanced story about the lives of young black people. So when I think about kind of takeaways from the book, one of the most important things for me is that it is really misleading to represent young black people in an either-or situation. And I think far too many members of the media and increasingly far too many members of black communities, especially black elites, have gotten on the kind of pathologize and demonize young black people. The easiest marker that I always throw out, of course, is Bill Cosby. But we could go down the list. We've seen Oprah do it. We've seen Spike Lee do it. I mean, you can go on and on and on, whether it's an attack on hip-hop or an attack on sagging pants or an attack on their failure of values. We've seen a kind of unidimensional, one-dimensional representation of black youth. And I think hopefully what the book does is allows young black people to tell their own stories in a nuanced way where we kind of move away from the extremes. The other significance or takeaway of the book for me is to understand the significance of young black people to the political future of this country. So first and foremost, when we look at, I would argue, some of the most challenging and critical issues confronting the country, whether it's the disproportionate impact of HIV and AIDS in the country, high rates of incarceration, the failures of public schools, those things disproportionately impact young black people. And there is no way to solve those crises, which impact really the future of this country, without dealing with, hearing from, and engaging young black people. So to me, this is not just a story about black communities. It's about the future of American politics. And I guess the third thing I would have people take away is I think what the situation of young black people in this country raises for me is a question not just of kind of what policies, but really what's the morality of this country. How is it that daily, almost without notice, we let 50% of young black people in urban areas, and in particular young black boys, drop out of high school? How is it that we incarcerate more young black people than we educate in terms of higher education? How is it that in a city like Chicago, where I live, young black kids are killed on the way to school? Not because they're in a gang, some of course are, but because they're walking to school, because they're taking a bus. And where is the moral outrage to say that is unacceptable, right? I mean, there is just, for me, a deep sadness to be in a country where we can accept that young people are not protected, uplifted, and valued. And so hopefully what the book also does is to push this question of what's the moral commitment of having a political community, not of citizenship, but of what do we mean by political community where every person's life is valued? And if that is what we say we are about, then what must we do to, in fact, make sure that happens for every young black person? So those are the takeaways from the book.
Thank you, Kathy, for that great opening. And I want to turn to our panelists with the last question you raised about how do we define really political citizenship, small c. What are the rights and responsibilities we owe to each other as a collective in this society? And I'm curious about how our panelists would define for themselves in their work and with the young people that they are engaged in, what does it mean to be politically engaged? We oftentimes use the word politics and think only about elected officials. But as we all know, politics is so much more deep than just being an elected official, with all due respect to our Representative Alicia Morgan Thomas. So I'm curious as to how our panelists see this whole issue of political engagement, civic engagement for the communities that they work with, and what role you see for the black youth that you engage in the question that Kathy posed of what will politics look like for this country in general. And maybe we could start with you, Edward, and kind of go down the row.
Good evening, everyone. As stated before, I'm Edward James, and I'm a blogger for the Black Youth Project. And before I go on with my answer to that question, I want to say that a lot of people are saying that I'm supposed to represent the young voice, right? So I just want to say, I never said any of you weren't young. I think everybody here looks like they can be like 21 to 25.
Oh. Good job.
But in terms of civic engagement for young people, I think that's a very interesting question. It's a question that I kind of struggle with every day. I'm actually doing research on how young black people use social networking sites and blogs as discursive spaces for political deliberation. I think it's really important that we start understanding civic engagement and political participation outside the lens of the traditional norms that we're used to, such as voting, going door to door, and canvassing. What I find very interesting is that when I look on Facebook and when I look on Twitter, I see a lot of young black people critiquing social institutions. And when I say critiquing social institutions, I mean something as simple as a young person saying that CPS, Chicago Public Schools, sucks. In layman's terms, it sucks. And you may say on its face, how is that critiquing social institutions? How is that getting to the root of the problem? But if you have 200,000 people on Facebook and Twitter saying something to the effect of CPS is failing us, CPS is not holding up its end of the deal, then that means that somehow somebody's missing out and somebody's missing the viewpoints of a lot of these young people. So what I say is it's important to look at these non-traditional spaces to really understand how young black people are participating and how they are engaged in politics. You know, pollsters are saying that, well, pollsters have said historically that minorities and young people don't participate in midterm elections. And they say numbers don't lie, but, you know, I also say that people manipulate numbers, but that's neither here nor there. But I think the point is that we need to start understanding what black youth actually feel about the political process. And I think that's what, and I know that's what Dr. Cohen does very well in this book. You know, she talks about in the age of Obama, how, you know, just a few days before the presidential election, when there was this spirit of optimism, this sense of hope in this country, that an overwhelming number of young black people still felt that they did not have full citizenship in this country. And I think that's important. But again, it's important that we look at these non-traditional spaces to really understand how young black people feel about the political process and about the United States government.
Thank you, Edward. Monifa, do you want to share in the work that you're doing at the National Coalition how you all see this question of defining citizenship and the role of black youth in that?
Absolutely. The National Coalition has a project called Black Youth Vote, and inside of all of our civic engagement programs, we make sure to identify and to resource a young person to work alongside community organizers and project coordinators in different cities to groom the next level of leadership, but also because we understand that one of the key reasons why there's a low level of civic participation amongst our young people around electoral politics is because that work to engage the young people in our community hasn't been resourced. I do a lot of traveling and working with on different issues, voter issues, environmental issues, and I'm always so happy to see young white people volunteering, going to conferences, going to trainings, and there's even a class issue with who's really able to participate on a certain level of organizing and in civic engagement. And the reality is that it's going to take a level of resources from us as community members and organizations, but also from foundations to be intentional when they want to see a rise in civic participation amongst black youth. And then I wanted to just add to that, that the challenge is not just the resources. The challenge is not just that there's not a lot of money out there to educate and mobilize young black voters. That is a challenge. But the second piece is that how do we ask a group of people to engage who are determined by all the social structures around them as outsiders, right? You're asking to participate in a system that has blocked you out of the core of it. And I think that if you don't walk the streets of Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights, if you're not stopped and frisked every day on your way to school, if you're not profiled, it can be easy to look at youth and say, well, what is really blocking you? People don't see physical chains or physical ropes around the young people in our community, but they're there, and they're actually more powerful when you think about the impact of these systemic barriers to participating. So not only are we under-resourced, there are also these obstacles in the way of participating. But with all of that, we do see a high level of civic engagement. It's not in electoral politics, but because we're outsiders, it's the politics of protest. We can rally, we can ignite a lot of emotional fervor in our community when there's issues of police brutality around the prison industrial complex, because that is something that we see, we identify, we've been stopped, we have cousins, we have aunts and uncles who are incarcerated, and we're enraged, and we will get engaged around those issues. Now, how do we translate that to a policy strategy? How do we translate that to us participating in electoral politics? I think that's what we have to figure out, but that's also what we have to resource.
And Aaron?
Could you ask your question again?
Sure. The basic question is, how do you see in your organization, the work that you're doing, the issue of how do we define democratic citizenship or political participation, civic engagement, and what role do you see black youth playing in that redefinition or reimagining?
Yeah, so I think I'll focus on the reimagining. For me, the work that I've been doing with young people really starts with creating a space and then providing sort of the resources to help them to understand some of these larger systems. I remember just feeling so angry when I was young, you know, just infuriated all the time and not being able to understand exactly why. You know, what is going on that is creating this deep frustration that I feel, you know, it's not like somebody did anything to me personally, or maybe they had in some cases, but just that understanding of the systems and the structures and what is racism, what is classism, what is capitalism, what is the effect that capitalism has on us, why are we working so hard and never making a living, like all these larger questions that I think are rolling around in their heads, but we aren't having the conversations with them about this stuff, you know. And so I really believe that when we're able to start to analyze and break some of these things down into pieces that I can bite off and chew, then I start to understand it. Then I understand I can do something about it. You know, the hopelessness that I can't do anything about this thing It disappears when you're knowledge, when you have the knowledge and the understanding, and then you get the organizing skills and the strategy chart and all those other skills that build. And it's sort of a system of sort of just building and building and building until you have a young person that leads, you know, the protest, that decides to get arrested behind stuff that's going on in the schools or otherwise, you know. And it's a process. And so I really believe that we invest in creating the space so that process can happen. And when it does and it comes to fruition, then that's sort of that empowerment that we're looking for. But it's in sort of planting a seed and nurturing it and growing it over time. And there's no other way to do it. You know, it doesn't magically happen. So you have to have the resources. You have to have the systems, the structures, the organizers in place, and the classroom and all of these other resources to sort of magically make that happen. And so that's sort of that's where I'm at with that. That's what I think.
Thank you, Aaron. And Alicia, as the elected official on our panel, who has a unique vantage point of not only yourself being an elected official, but working with other elected officials at various levels around the country, how do you come into this space, and what's your sense of the role of Black youth in defining what is democratic citizenship, what is political participation, civic engagement?
First, I want to say good evening to everyone, and thanks for this opportunity to participate in this discussion. And I'm really excited to be surrounded by great brilliance, not just on the panel, but in the room. Have had a great time meeting many of you. So I would like to start by briefly talking about my little story and how I got elected, because my story is very similar to a lot of my colleagues within the Young Elected Officials Network. I grew up in the NAACP, and so I started out as the youth council president in Miami, Florida, and later the Spelman College Chapter President and the State Youth and College Division President. And that's where I developed what I call, you know, the audacity to believe that young people are not leaders of tomorrow, but they lead and must lead today. And I decided once I was on Spelman's campus and organizing around juvenile justice issues and education issues and registering people to vote, even once I graduated from college, I realized that there was a gap. I was doing great work, but there was something more that needed to happen. And at the same time, I was working for an organization that required me to visit state capitals and in the southern region and train young people on how to organize around the issue of gun violence and particularly connect them to the public policy process. And all of that was great preparation to what I came to understand, that you can organize all you want, but there's a public policy piece that's connected to that. And if you want to make systemic change, if you want to create change for communities, for an entire state of people or an entire country, then you can, you know, public policy is a powerful way to do that. So what is civic engagement? It is protesting. It is volunteering in an organization, it's working in the soup kitchen, it's all of those things. I think the gap, though, and when we look at elections as an example, I laugh when I'm in the grocery store and someone will say to me, oh, so when are you going back to D.C.? Because they think I'm in Congress. And it wasn't a young person who would say that, it's always some older person who they don't understand the process. And so I want to make sure that when we have these conversations about young people, that we don't ignore the roles that older people play, or don't play for that matter, in terms of modeling what it means to participate in the process. Not just volunteering, but also voting. The last point that I want to make is that there is a gap between those issues that people are directly impacted by and voting, or supporting a candidate in whatever way that means, voting, but then even after the election, holding elected officials accountable. And I believe that that doesn't happen for a couple of reasons. Number one, people are not connected to the process. They don't understand that in addition to protesting, in addition to writing a letter or posting something on Facebook or yelling and screaming at the kitchen table, there's also a piece about I have a voice that I can use and talk to those people who are making the decisions about the water I drink, the air that I breathe, the poor education in too many communities. And so so there's the piece about not being connected, but there's also a lack of connection for elected officials who get elected And other than the every 2 years going to the church and kissing the babies, there's not a lot of communication with their constituents. And so I think there has to be a two-way connection of elected officials. But the bottom line is regarding the individuals in our organization, the Young Elected Officials Network, these are courageous young people who are progressive and have decided that I'm not waiting for somebody to show me what to do, or I'm not waiting for my legislator to pass the policy that I want. I'm going to do it myself. And I think there's a responsibility on behalf of young people today to, yes, acknowledge those challenges exist in our communities, but there's also a responsibility and a legacy that's already been created that I can do this myself as well.
Thank you, Alicia. And Biko, your organization works particularly with young people who are not in college, as many of the organizations that are supported by philanthropy are usually focused on college campuses. But so many young black youth don't have that opportunity, or for whatever reason are not on college campuses. Can you speak to us about how the young folks that you're working with day in and day out look at the issue of democratic citizenship, of civic engagement, participation, and what you see as the role of black youth in redefining what that means in this society?
Mine and Alicia's story are the exact opposite. You know, I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and was a jock. You know, if it weren't for sports, you know, and my parents going bankrupt twice to send me to private schools, you know, I wouldn't be in this room today. It wasn't until, you know, I was actually sparked by the National Hip Hop Political Convention in 2004 that I even understood that electoral politics worked. I voted because my dad would kick my butt if I didn't, you know, and because he was a union guy. But I didn't really understand the connection. And I think the thing that I'm really excited about is that Kathy's book reaffirms a lot of the things that I've been seeing in the community. Young black people are engaged. You know, like, you know, 2004 to 2008, we see this uptick in youth vote, and everybody's talking about how there's an increase in youth vote. But if you take a magnifying glass and look at it, it's really black youth that are coming out at incredible numbers. And I, you know, that's been my life story with the League of Young Voters over the last 4 years. I know that one of the difficulties also that you see in the book is that without a real agenda, you know, we're not creating real strategies that are long-lasting. I think the generation before us and the generation before them were blessed with incredible insight to look into the future and know that they had to chip away at the 14th Amendment and Brown versus Plessy versus Ferguson so they could get Brown versus Board. The next generation picked it up and tried to implement that, and we're left with a thing like GINA 6, which is, in theory, something that we should, it's a tactical thing as opposed to a strategic thing. And so our young people were in the game, but we're really not playing the game. And so what the League of Young Voters does is we want to turn young people, especially non-college youth, people of color, into stakeholders into the civic process. We want to go from opposition to proposition. You know, I know a lot of things that we talk about is protest and, you know, marching or boycotts, and that's a cool reactionary strategy. But this generation is the most powerful young black generation ever. It's the most powerful young generation ever, as you see as they come in.
Exactly.
Give them a round of applause because they're in here. As I know, when I was their age, I was not coming to anything like this.
Thank you. Welcome to all of you.
And so with us, with the League, what we do is I'll give a quick story about a young lady we work with named by the name of Lanisha Martin. I first met Lanisha Martin when she was 19 years old at a funeral of a young man who worked with us. Her friend had died. She had lost a lot of friends. She got up at the pulpit and was very passionate. I was like, oh my God, this young lady is amazing. We like come to our meetings. She kept coming to our meetings. She actually got, because a lot of youth, you know, go back and forth between the formal and informal economy when she lost her job, actually got in a little bit of trouble with the police a couple years ago. Actually, last time I was in here at OSI, I was at a meeting where she and I started crying because she had just got arrested, and I thought she was going to go to jail for a while. But she didn't. She did so well with the judicial system that her public attorney gave her a job. After, she's like, you're way too smart. Let's give you a job. She's now on her way to be a paralegal. She just came back from the CBC boot camp and actually was recognized for having the most detailed field plan. And when you see this girl, she's a gold teeth, dreadlocked hood girl. She just started work on a community college, but we invested in her. She understands the difference between state, local, and federal politics. He understands, a lot of people understand that this is my block, but she understands that's my park. Those are my police. You know, that's my governor. You know, that's my prison. And I think through the process of really giving them the skills, you can see young folks like this really do a lot with very little.
Thank you, Biko. Did you want to say something about that, Kathy?
I'll be quick. I just want to underscore two points. One thing that Biko said that I think is really important. First is this myth that young black people won't turn out, that in 2008, you know, all the talk of the youth vote, let's be very clear, the youth vote was driven in 2008 by black and Latino youth. In fact, there was no increase among white youth between 2004 and 2008. So they will turn out. Two, it is the question, I think, however, of relevance. So they turned out, but they didn't turn out because of the Democratic Party. They didn't turn out because of the Democratic agenda. They turned out because it was a historic election to elect Barack Obama, the first African-American president. So I think we have to figure out kind of what is the relevance of the political system and civic engagement for young black people that would make them turn out. I mean, I understand that we have this idea that, quote unquote, as citizens you turn out, but there's nothing that says that they should. You know, when we interviewed a number of the young black folks who are highlighted in the book, they talked about the fact that they had been raised actually with black mayors. I mean, this is a generation of young people who have seen black officials up close and who have seen over their time no change in their school system, increasing incarceration. So the myth of black officials, no offense, changing their lives is not something they're buying into, right? So I do think kind of an agenda of relevance, the resources to mobilize, the recognition that it can't be about parties as they are constructed right now, and that, in fact, what we may be looking for is the kind of alternative ego to the Tea Party among black youth who will say, I'm alienated, I'm angry, and I'm taking this over. So that's all.
Thank you. I know we have time for, I think, one more question. Okay, of our panelists. And I want to get into this issue that Aaron raised about space, about providing space for young black people to come together, talk about what should be their agenda, to develop a strategy. And tied to that, I think, is a question of voice. How do we empower young black folks and give them the opportunities and the resources to be their own spokespeople, to assume the mantle of leadership, as Alicia talked about? Do you want to talk a little bit about the issue of space and voice? Would you like to start us off again, Edward?
Sure. I just want to echo Dr. Cohen's sentiments again that we need to get beyond this notion that black faces in high places actually mean something for the lived experiences of black people in this country, specifically young black people. As noted in the book, again, Professor Cohen pointed out that although there was this period in this country where it seemed like change was sweeping through the United States of America, it seemed as if the tide was turning, young black people still felt that the institutions were failing them. And many still today feel like institutions have failed them. And I think that's why it is imperative. Instead of emphasizing symbolism in this country, I think we need to go beyond symbolism, because black exceptionalism doesn't do anything for the kid on the south side of Chicago who is going to inferior schools. Black exceptionalism doesn't do anything for the kid who is a convicted felon and doesn't have access to public housing, doesn't have access to social services because of racial discrimination, because of a white supremacist hierarchy in this country. What we need to emphasize for young black people is how to get involved and how to restructure policy, how we can set our own agenda. You know, it's absolutely outrageous that in the state of Florida, 84% of juveniles sentenced to life without parole for non-homicidal offenses were black. And I can go on with all the statistics about the dropout rates. I can go on and on about all the statistics about the incarceration rates. But it's important that we actually emphasize policy. It's important that we do something to help the self-efficacy of young black people. And by self-efficacy, I mean the way young black people feel that they actually can influence the process. And that's, I think, starts with, you know, the old term that all politics is local. I'm happy that our president is black. I still think we need to hold him accountable. But why don't we, you know, encourage our black youth to go to school board meetings, to go to city council meetings, because that those are the policies that are actually going to affect them more quickly than any policy at the federal level. But again, we have to get beyond this false sense that having a black president or a black governor or a black mayor means that we can close the book on civil rights. It's really important that young black people, you know, set our own agenda. And as Professor Cohen brought up, maybe it's time for alternative to the Tea Party movement. They say they want to water the tree of liberty. I'm just saying, I think young black people, I know young black people have the power, and I know young black people are outraged. I know young black people want to influence the policies, but it's important that we set a clear agenda. The Tea Party movement is already setting an agenda, and if we don't get a hold of this country soon, they're going to cut out the education department, because yes, there are candidates who want to cut out the education department, and there are even some who believe that unemployment benefits are unconstitutional. All this stuff may sound outrageous, but this is the times that we're living in, and it's important that we get control of our own narratives.
Thank you, Edward. Monifa, do you want to speak to the issue of voice and the kinds of spaces that the National Coalition is able to create for young black people to give them voice and to give wider, I guess, audience to their issues?
Yeah, I think we think it's really important to tell the truth, and I noticed that with all of the panelists here, we're kind of echoing this same consensus that if we continue to pretend that black youth there aren't systemic obstacles to their participation, we really do them a disservice, and we take the space away. Right, because basically we're telling a lie, we're creating a myth about the availability and the accessibility of that space. So most importantly, we have to recognize sometimes and deconstruct our own privilege. I like to always tell when I'm around exceptional black people of all ages to say, it is good to tell young people, I did it, you can do it too. But we have to immediately understand the danger in that statement and follow it up with the fact that there are some real things that are obstacles. You know, it's kind of like saying, well, you know, this person survived the mid-Atlantic slave trade and these other people didn't. No, you know, you have to really point out what the realities are in people's lives, because when we are shown, just like with Obama, we're shown like as an example as like post-racial, because we're able to do some incredible things that Biko's talking about, some of these young people are able to do. But that doesn't mean that the systems and the institutions don't need to work hard and provide those spaces. So the spaces are resourced. We have to find a way to identify young people, give them the resources to participate, and then we have to back up. In structuring this panel, we said we want to make sure we hear from the young people in the audience and everything, and sometimes that's hard, but a lot of times, like what Kathy had to do with her book, I'm sure, is listen. And that space is difficult to create for those of us who talk a lot and who run institutions and who are organizers and field directors, but it's the resources, we have to tell the truth, and then we have to back up and be quiet and let young people speak.
Thank you. We're getting a little bit low on time because we definitely do want to open this conversation up to those in the audience. Aaron, you made first reference to the question of space. Do you want to share anything else about what you all are doing in North Carolina to address this issue of providing space for young black people to lift up their voices?
Well, that's a serious question. There are a couple of campaigns in North Carolina that I'm involved in that are trying to create some of this space, and we don't have it perfectly put together. But one of them, I guess one of the things I'll say is that we have what we call Historic Thousands on Jones Street Coalition, which is a anti-racist, anti-poverty coalition of about 100 organizations. They support a 14-point people's agenda that lays out education, health care, housing. I mean, you can look, it's called hkonj.com. You can look up the agenda. But this idea that and that young people ought to be a part of sort of creating that agenda and helping to move that agenda forward. The other thing I just want to say quickly, too, just to build on what I've already heard around sort of creating the narrative and the story, the idea is that we actually can do something about this together, right? If we work together, we can do something about this together. And it's not about me as an individual, it's about us as a collective. And if you think about the messages that you do hear from the right and the story that they're telling us, all they ever say is that it's about you, the individual, the profit maker, the shareholder, it's about you, right? And as long as as we allow them to continue to focus on the profits over the people, we'll always be sort of struggling with how do we tell our story, how do we do this work, how do we resource it. And so I think we just really need to step back from all of that and realize that collectively, if we decided in this room we wanted to do something, we could pull our resources together and do whatever we wanted to. I mean, it's really that, you know, that simple. So,
Alicia, do you want to make a comment on that? Or Biko, either of you, before we move to the
I have some comments, but it's not specifically about space, so I'm going to yield, but I hope to have some time to respond to the issue of having more black elected officials but not seeing a lot of change. And I'd like
okay,
to
that's
that.
Definitely an issue we would love to get into. Biko, did you want to speak to the question of voice and space?
Yeah, I watched this movie on HBO, or was a series called John Adams, or was John was it John Adams? How many of you guys saw John Adams on HBO? And I watched the movie, and I think I read the book as well, and I realized how they had no idea what they were doing. We have to let, and I said this when I was with Bakari one time, and I haven't said it since the time, we have to let young people of color practice democracy. They have to get in the practice of debating, you know, facilitation, Robert Rules of Order, because without that practice of democracy, what we're seeing is the pent-up frustration and anger and disenfranchisement turning into self-hate and violence. And I think, you know, with the young people that I see, they, you know, have facilitating meetings, you know, having discussions, talking to elected officials, you know, pulling out the flip camera and bird dogging candidates. You know, when you see them doing this, you're seeing them grow exponentially. Every campaign that a young person goes through, 2-3 months of intense every day, 8 o'clock, reporting, I've seen leaps and bounds these young people growing all across the country. And if we can provide this sort of with a really small, you know, comparatively investment, the whole country can do this. And I really think that we have the most accountable, because all of them are on Facebook. You can't get away with too much stuff because everybody's going to see it, or they're going to tweet about it, or they're going to put it on YouTube and take a picture and everybody's going to see it. We have the most accountable, connected, technologically savvy generation. We just have to invest in them. Let them make some mistakes and get out of the way.
Thank you. And I know we're short on time, so these are some interesting themes came up in these last few comments about the role of black elected officials, what that means and doesn't mean in terms of leadership. Leaders are not the people who necessarily hold a position, but we are all leaders in our own right, and how do we foster that for young black people? How do we make more effective uses of technology to help young black people not only own their own voice, but to engage in campaigns, make the kind of changes they want to see. But I think we're going to open it up now, Rashid, to the audience for those who may have a question. I see lots of anxious hands going up, people waving.
So the way we're going to facilitate this really quickly is that we're going to allow the young people first, if they have any questions, to ask questions, if they have questions. But if not, we'll open it up to the broader audience. And what I'll do is the second one, I'm going to ask people to line up and actually ask your questions. So if you have questions, come up to the mic and ask your question. But for the young people, I'll hold this mic. And if you have questions, let me know, raise your hand, and just let me know at any point so we can facilitate that.
And don't be shy.
Thank you.
How to get up for? Whatever you want.
Good night, everybody. I just want an overview about the meeting. So you guys are pretty much explaining how we will have more rights and how we'll be able to be more like politically bound. That's pretty
old.
Much all, all right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's what the only question I have.
Yeah, you can tell. You can tell.
Thank you for the question. I'm sorry that we didn't do that when you all came in. Essentially, what we're doing is discussing a book called Democracy Remixed, Black Youth and the Future of American Politics. It's authored by Professor Kathy Cohen, the lady sitting at the end, and the issues that come out of research that she has done around the political engagement and the political thoughts and concerns of young black people. And the people who are assembled here on the panel, we have Edward James, who is a blogger on a website called the blackyouthproject.org, University of Chicago, Sorry?
.com.
I apologize. Excuse me. I'm so used to org. It's nonprofit world. Excuse me. .com. And Monifa Bandelli is a woman who works with an organization called the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. They have a program called the Black Youth Vote that, again, is trying to get young black people civically engaged. And Aaron is with Blueprint North Carolina, an organization also is working on civic engagement issues, and she has done organizing around engaging teenagers in particular. Alicia Thomas Morgan is next. She actually is the first black person to be elected to the Georgia House of Representatives. She represents the community in Cobb County, I think it is, in Metro Detroit. And at the very end is Biko Baker, who is the executive director of an organization called the League of Young Voters, which focuses specifically on civic engagement for young people who are not in college and young people who happen to come from low-income communities of color. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of context.
So we'll open it up to the questions to the audience.
Yeah, hello. My name is Mark. I just wanted to say, Dr. Cole, I'm looking forward to reading your book as I come from the lineage that, you know, you just do the same argument over and over again. It's kind of like making lemonade out of lemons. I mean, the question I always ask is why does this happen? I mean, there is a new black electorate, and they come from Benin, they come from Gambia, they come from Senegal. They're in Harlem, where I live. Their parents braid hair and sell Muslim oils, but their kids are getting A's in school. It is what this gentleman said here. It's self-efficiency. It is the black American youth. The person that I read a lot, Dr. George Leary, calls it the black slave syndrome. It is us. I mean, I don't understand why. I mean, when I was growing up, I'm part of the hip-hop generation. They didn't give any credit to the Latino brothers who contributed a lot to the hip-hop culture. It's something about us that we just don't want to see reality as it is. It is us. I mean, I really don't understand it. I mean, there is a new black electorate. His father is Kenyan and his mother was white. Get over it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that these things are important to our communities. And unless we have this dialogue amongst ourselves, what do we expect the other community to do anything about anything? It's the same thing over and over and over again.
Personally speaking,
before you say something, and I'm going to tell you this, I'm a product, like a lot of these people in this room, my parents are West Indian, so don't go there. I was raised by West Indian parents, so, you know, before even the hip-hop generation, you know, West Indian parents didn't play that. So it is us. It's black Americans. Something about our position here in America we're not comfortable with. Our young people aren't learning from us to be comfortable with it, and it's just making a whole lot of problems.
Okay, you got to let the brother speak for himself. And you can go anywhere you want. I got your back.
Anywhere,
so, yeah. anywhere you want.
Personally speaking, as you say, it's our fault as young African Americans. You can't really say that because I know firsthand when I was younger, teachers probably not, you know, pushing us to as far as we need to be because everybody can't be in a top paid school because maybe financially their families they don't have the money for it. So, you know, most likely in some public schools, I'm not going to say all, but some public schools, the teachers don't push them as hard as they should. As of my school or any other school, a Catholic school that I go to, since it's not that many people in the school, you know, they know me and they learn to grow around me. So they know my weaknesses and my strengths. So they push my weaknesses so I can get stronger. But everybody can't do that because in public schools is 2,000 kids in the whole school and there's 40 kids a class. So you can't single out everybody. As of for me in my class, in my school, it's probably like 20 kids a class. So you can't really say it's our fault. And, you know, everyone can't be in the top paid schools. That's all I want to say.
And this actually, the gentleman's question raises something that Kathy and I were talking about before we started the program. It's not a simple issue, right? It's complex. It's multifaceted. And one of the differences between those of us whose family happened to have been born in this country and those who weren't is, in fact, the legacy of slavery. And one of the issues that we don't talk about as a society, even within the black community, is what are the lasting impacts of that legacy? How, not only is it a question of the historical impacts, but how that continues to show up day in and day out now, simply by, as someone pointed on the panel pointed out, just judging somebody based upon how they're dressed. You know, all the, what one of our members in the audience is with an organization called, I think it's the American, My basic point is implicit bias is a serious problem in this society. It not only infects the larger society, but black people ourselves. One of the really compelling stories at the beginning of Kathy's book is about a young man, 16-year-old kid, who just happened to be walking home from school and was beat to death. Now, what makes a young black child want to kill another young black child like that? I think there are lots of deeper issues that we have to get into. It's not simply a question of, oh, there's something wrong with you black people, and it's not just a question of the young people themselves or their families. The structural piece, the environmental piece, all of those systems come together. It very much is a complicated problem and an issue, and I don't think we advance the cause by pointing fingers at each other. The question I think we're trying to address tonight is how can we, as Aaron was saying, work together as a collective, recognizing it's a complicated problem. There's a role for all of us to play.
I'm going to go real fast because that brother, I would love to talk to that brother on a corner somewhere outside here, but I'm going to go 30 seconds. In the book, she talks about moral panics and how society will quickly respond to some of the things about black folks and, you know, start sending the culture police after folks. We also have political panics in this country. That's the difference between us and the Caribbean. You can see 1919 after folks coming from World War One, Tulsa, Chicago, people killing black people literally because they're coming up. We see the same thing happen after the 60s, Barry Goldwater, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan. A response to the success of the civil rights movement and people intentionally using policy to disenfranchise and undermine black communities. So whereas it's a different dynamic, brother. We can have the conversation afterwards, but it's much more nuanced. And I encourage you to pick up the book, and you can get it at Borders for only $27.95.
We got a free copy. You got a free copy, yeah.
Is it my turn?
Uh-huh.
I'm Bakari Kitswana. I want to underscore something that Biko said that I think is a very important point, and I want to relate that to a question to Kathy about the book. The point that Biko made about the young people that he works with that are really doing important work and who are engaged, I think that one of the things that I see happening is that those people are not legitimized by the process. I authored this study, which was the study was done by Zero Divide. What they did is they took $1 million and they invested it in 16 grassroots activist organizations who use hip hop arts and activism to engage the community. And so the findings are in this report. It's online. It's a digi book. You can also get it at zerodivide.org. So I want to say that. But the question, Kathy, that kind of builds off that is, what are the ways that you see that the mainstream electoral process delegitimizes young black people, even though they are politically engaged? What are the ways that you see that process delegitimize?
Right, right. So as a disclaimer, Bakari blurbed the book, right? So he said good things about the book. So, you know, so he's a plant in the audience. I mean, one of the things, let's take the idea, for example, of the youth vote, right? I am amazed by how many pieces I have read about the youth vote and what the youth vote is going to do, this kind of generational divide. That if, in fact, for example, if you talk about social issues, if you just wait 10 more years, social issues like same-sex marriage or abortion will no longer be considered because, in fact, this new generation, the millennials, have a completely different take. Matt Bai just had a piece in the New York Times recently that talked both about, compared the Tea Party and the NAACP, and said the problem with both is that basically they're composed of members who are old, and if we just hold on, young people are going to change it all. Well, the reality is the youth vote actually is not true. There's no such thing as the youth vote. And historically, if you look, in fact, the way young black people and young whites in particular have mobilized around, for example, the presidency, it has always been kind of on a different trajectory. Not only the 2008, but young black people have been mobilized, for example, at their height around when Jesse Jackson ran. young whites were mobilized at their height around Kerry and Bill Clinton, right? So there's a way in which we don't pay attention to and disaggregate even the data that we present when we talk about young people. We rarely kind of talk about young black people, and I don't mean to say this as versus young white people. Second thing very quickly is I think we have, for example, in the case of black politics, I think we have old models of what politics looks like, right? So when I go out and I talk to like the Urban League, no offense to anybody who's in the Urban League, they'll say, well, tell me about young black people. Are they out there boycotting? And the truth is our data suggests about 2 to 4% say they've been involved in a boycott. If you ask about boycotting, right, because this is a consumer culture, these are young people who want to buy. If you ask them about boycotting, do you make decisions about what you buy based on the values and the norms of a company, 25% of young blacks will say, yeah, I've thought about what companies represent, and I make decisions in terms of consumer culture and consumer power based on those values, right? So if we think about boycotting as a form of political engagement and civic engagement, the engagement of young blacks looks very different than if we utilize kind of just boycotting. Right. If we only think about kind of protest models, where in fact we don't sustain those models, whether it's about Sean Grant or Gina Six or Oscar Grant, right, then we also start to talk about kind of the disengagement of young blacks versus if we look at their engagement on the web as they engage in blogs, right? This whole kind of report that said, who's on Twitter? Young African Americans are on Twitter. Well, is Twitter valuable? Are the opinions expressed on Twitter valuable? So I think that there's a way in which we have to kind of reorient what is civic participation, what's valuable political participation, and how do we in fact provide an infrastructure and resources so young black folks can take what they're doing there and, just like Biko said, make mistakes, do things right, and build their own movement. But it can't be dictated both from kind of black political elite or old-time white political models.
Hi, my name is Chris Johnson. I'm the executive director of the Horizons Leadership Project, and I'd like to thank you all for participating in this. It was a wonderful discussion. There were times when I was a little disappointed where I thought the direction of the conversation was going. I was glad to see Biko and a couple of the people pull it back into the things that are really positive that are happening with young people who are involved in civic engagement and being active, because I think that there are tons of examples of that. I look at the environmental justice movement, and I think that you can look at young African American and Latino people who are very, very active around those issues. Monife also mentioned around policing issues and the great examples of what young African American and Latino youth were doing, and I think would have accomplished if it hadn't been for September 11th and how much that drastically changed things here in New York. I think our city was headed in a dramatically different direction that would have probably been copied all over the country if there had been successful reform in the police department. And I think you can also look at education as an example. About 10 years ago, there was going to be a cut in education, and for one of the first time, the hip-hop community became actively engaged here in New York about trying to do something about dealing with cuts in education. And there were protests that were led at City Hall, as an example. And it was one of the first times that Russell Simmons became involved in that. And I'm not saying he's done great things since then, but he was able to turn young people out. Now, that's where I think that we have to start having conversations about stuff now, is that it was a lost opportunity, because there were thousands of young people who turned out because they knew that people from the hip-hop community were going to be there by entertainers and stuff like that. And they had coupled with the teachers' union. And the teachers' union, who don't always have young people's of color's best interests in mind, but in this instance did, and were the experts on this issue, were made to speak after everyone in the hip-hop community spoke. And so, of course, everybody dispersed. And so it was a real missed opportunity. And so as we talk about black elected officials and stuff like that, I think what also happens, which happens, I think, in general in the liberal community, we have missed opportunities. It's not enough to elect a David Dinkins. It's not enough to elect a Barack Obama and then say we've done our job, we can go home and leave it to them to do the job. And I think that that's what happened. You went down a list of things that have happened in American history where things have dramatically changed for people in the African American community, in particular, but poor people. And the reaction is, too often, is we work really, really hard, we make tremendous sacrifices, and then we think, okay, it's our time to rest. Now we get to celebrate life. And on the other side, they do the exact opposite. And so I think that we have to now, you know, Monife, you talked about the importance of this balance of talking about opportunity and educating our young people, but also being very, very careful and making sure that they also understand that there are going to be pitfalls and that the society isn't really set up for them to succeed. So walking that fine line. But I think that we have to walk that fine line, and that has to become like the biggest conversation about, you know, how we can support young people, how we can make sure that they stay engaged, and that we do agenda-driven things. This idea of copying the Tea Party, I think, is horrible, horribly wrong, because they're not about an agenda. They're about yelling and screaming. And the media likes to cover the easy thing, which is yelling and screaming. And so you have a lot of, in many cases, poor white people who don't benefit from what they're talking about, who are backing that up. But that's not going anywhere productive for the Republicans or anybody else, certainly not for our country. We don't need to do that. When we've been most successful, it's been because SNCC and SCLC and Thinkers, the Panthers, and people like that had a real agenda, had real ideas, and didn't want to just do the loud, the easy, the what do we get a shining light on us for. So I'm hoping that that's the kind of conversations that we'll have. And I'd love to hear what you guys' thoughts are about that.
Could I briefly respond to that? Because I was the one who talked a lot about the Tea Party movement. I, by no means, I'm not saying that we should emulate the Tea Party movement or any movement that just spews vitriol and hate. What I am saying is that it is a well-oiled machine, and they are loud, and they are getting noticed. And that's the point. And I'm not saying that just being loud is enough to influence public policy, but I am saying that we as young black people need to set a clear agenda of what we want, a 5-point plan, a 10-point plan. I'm not saying that everyone has the same interest in mind, but there are certain issues that are important to all of us. Education, fair housing, you know, the criminal justice system. Those are some of the issues that we need to mobilize around. And I'll tell you what, the Tea Party may be loud, but they're getting noticed. And all I'm saying is that young black people need to find a way to mobilize in such a way that we create our own agenda. Like I said, we take control of our own narrative and don't allow political elites and media elites to define who we are and what we represent. And that's what I meant. So I hope that clears it up.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
I want to jump in and this. There's so much to say. And I actually want to go back to the other brother who it may appear that he was jumped on a little bit. But I want to say that there is a sense of personal and community responsibility that we should have. And I don't want to allow a conversation to be had without offering another point, and that is that, number one, not all young black people, you know, have to be frisked on the way home or risk being shot. There are plenty of young people who don't have those systemic issues to deal with and are still choosing not to be excellent. Not saying that those things don't exist for some communities, but not all young people have that to deal with. I think about the issue of education that this young brother brought up. When we look at some of the challenges in education in our country, it's adults oftentimes, whether it's the teachers' unions or other people, who are standing in the way because their agenda is not kids. It's jobs, it's adults, it's protecting a system that may or may not be working. When a young person stands up and says that there is, when he's at a public school, and that's just that example because there are plenty of public schools that do what his Catholic school is doing, but when you have a young person who says that there are teachers who ignore students and they don't care about their strengths or their weaknesses and they aren't doing things to develop them, we can't keep blaming kids for the things that are going wrong, and we have to look at what's going on with adults. The last point that I want to interject really quickly is that talking about this black elected official piece, I'm going to do a shameless plug of my book, No Apologies, Powerful Lessons in Life, Love, and Politics. But one of the things that I talk about in this book is, yes, we have more black elected officials than we've ever had, but on every social indicator, education, healthcare, housing, whatever, black folks are at the bottom. And I believe that it is not because these black elected officials are just so bad or whatever, but again, it goes back to how involved is the electorate and what is the level of expectation? Because insanity means doing the same thing and expecting different results, right? But what is it when you have no expectations? And so, yes, Barack Obama has been elected, but how many of us are doing things at the state level to ensure that he can be successful? Many of us thought that if we just elect him, then I'm just going to take it on back to the House, and I've done my job.
But where is the responsibility of the electorate? Where is the responsibility of other people who have said, this is the role that I'm going to play? Where are, when you talk about this morality of black kids in education and the dropout rate, where is the outrage of the grown people who have said, I'm tired of this system that has undereducated me, now undereducating my children? And so we have to insert that in the conversation.
Okay, just very quick. So I think we agree on everything. Maybe not everything, but I think mostly. I think it's absolutely right to say, where are the parents, where are the aunts and uncles, where are the folks in the community? And I think this goes back also to kind of the balance between they have to be outraged, right? But also the recognition, when I talk to, for example, a lot of parents, and I say, well, how come you're not out there in the streets? They said, look, I got to find a good school for my kid, right? So I know you want me to be on the streets, but what I got to do is go down the list of charter schools. And I got to put an application in for a lottery. And I got to try to meet with the principal so I can get my kid into that. So I also want to recognize that, and I want to be careful saying grown folks, because, you know, 18 to 25, some those grown folks too, they're just young grown mm-hmm. folks, right? And those are grown folks with kids also, right?
Mm-hmm.
That older folks of color and marginalized folks in this country also work under systems of oppression, right? They're also trying to keep a job and work a job. And I'm not making excuses for them because, in fact, throughout the book I try to say that there has to be a recognition of the question of agency and how, in fact, we also have personal responsibility. But I want to make sure we don't ever go either way, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, parenting, because what was really interesting was how quickly young black kids, when we would talk to them, would revert back to the narratives of, well, it's just bad parenting. The bad kids have bad parents, right? And the bad kids make bad decisions. And it really took a while to hear them talk systemically about the other things that they were facing. So I'm all for kind of, yes, it's about personal responsibility. Yes, it should be about kind of moral outrage of a community, but also understanding the pressures of those communities and also kind of the history of trauma, psychological trauma that community has experienced over time.
Aaron?
I just want to also add to that the role of sort of capitalism in our system that prides on sucking the lifeblood out of working
Absolutely.
Families at every single level. And then the right with this model of the individual is responsible for itself, so we can always point to you and say, you're the reason you're poor, and you're the reason you're broke, and you're the reason you're incarcerated, and not have to look at the other millions of other people that are poor, that don't have jobs, that are incarcerated. And so I really struggle with the personal responsibility versus the systems, you know, and how do you bring those, you know, together without pointing to somebody and saying that they are the problem because they are X. Because that's not going to resolve anything, and it's not the truth. I'm sorry, you've been standing there for a while.
Patricia?
Hi, everyone. I'm Patricia Gerardo, and I want to thank you so much for, you know, a big thank you to all the panelists. I did want to do a big plug for symbolism, because I think it is very important to us. And just for me personally, it wasn't until, you know, I had a black mayor, I saw David Deacons in office, and I saw what a horrible job he did, that it really cleared up for me the systems behind it. And I think symbolism is not the answer, but until we get through that, then we can see, oh, okay, our problems aren't going to be solved by this. But until we have those examples in hand, we do keep it up there as, you know, as this, you know, as this fable that will actually be the answer. And we need to experience it, not just keep it as symbolism, for us to move past to the next point. My quick question, hopefully it's quick, and I'll talk to you all after if we don't get a chance to really address it. What's one thing that Biko had said that kind of tapped into my experience as well was being a child of union members and having that as part of your tradition. And there was just, you get out and you vote, and that's what you do, and it becomes a tradition. Even when you don't understand why you're doing it, it's the practice, it's the expectation that happens. And so I am interested in what you all see as systems of engagement that need to exist in order that we're not just looking at youth individually participating or elected officials getting out the vote or even the parties being able to do that, but what in the community is needed to build and support the practice of civic engagement?
That's a really good question.
I read it very quickly, but there was a couple times where you compared church-going youth with non-church-going youth and how sometimes there is no difference, but other times there's a huge difference. And, can you talk about the institutions of church or
well,
something?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the literature, for example, in political science has found that in places that don't look political, people learn skills that allow them to feel more comfortable doing political acts. The church is a clear one, right, that people feel like they learn about deliberation, they have a sense of mobilization because their pastor's standing up saying don't forget to vote on Tuesday, that there are people in the church who will maybe ask you did you vote, so there's a sense of accountability. So in fact, that's one of the things. Now, there's some downsides to religiosity, which were they were less tolerant around other issues. But I, as also a child of a union family, I learned that lesson also. The other thing I was going to say is, you know, a lot of people are pointing now to, and I'm not a big fan, but of service learning, that in fact incorporating the idea of political practice, and it's really not political practice, that's the problem with service learning, into schools where young people, and maybe the young people here can talk about, are expected to think, deliberate, and engage in some type of political project is also another place, even if families are not voting. The problem is that we see kind of racial disparities there, that kids from higher income schools get more opportunities to engage in service learning, and kids from less resource school, of course, are so busy studying for the tests because it's a race to the top that they don't get the experiences of service learning. So that's another issue.
I wanted to say something really quick to that point. Biko and the sister that just spoke talk about a culture within the home of voting, right, specifically. And that is how young people are engaged on so many levels. It's what's the culture in the household. So we have to be very, again, truth-telling in the fact that many adults in our community are disenfranchised. So when you talk about how do you create a space where young people like those in the union get that practice of voting, how do you create that space? You have to eliminate the obstacles to the franchise for the rest of the community, right? Because if my father can't vote, then I probably don't vote, and my kids don't, and that culture is not present. And we still have places like in Mississippi where 1 in 4 black men are disenfranchised. That's a huge amount of families and households. And then you're talking about 2, 3, 4 kids in those households and then their friends. So the culture is always linked to a material reality that exists within the community. And if we really think we can find what the link is and work on what that systemic issue is. Yes, I'm so sorry. So in many states across the country, if someone has a felony conviction, meaning they've served time in prison of over a year for a particular crime, their right to vote is taken away. And states decide how much of your right to vote they want to take away. And we have some states in the country that take away a person's right to vote for the rest of their lives. So they went to prison, serve time for a felony, they're out, they may be working or not working or have family members, they pay taxes, whatever, but they can no longer participate in the electoral process. And that's a lot of people in many states, and it is disproportionately black people.
Can I add one quick thing about ways that we can engage people systematically outside of elections? I think using our organizations, our nonprofit organizations, who are advocates for particular groups of people or particular issues. I think that we could all do a better job and continue to do for those that are, and there are a lot that are, to get more people based on, you know, if homelessness is my issue, then to just to educate those folks who have that interest and then to use that to engage in the public policy process. So the election is long gone. Now let's engage in the process and either push for a particular policy, you know, advocate against it, whatever the position is. And then on an individual level, I always try to encourage people that we each have expertise in different areas. And so to not be afraid of the system or this big marble building where city council meetings are held or the legislature or whatever, but to pick up the phone and call an elected official and weigh in on a particular issue. Oftentimes, as a legislator, and I'm in Georgia, you know, I make $17,000 a year. Clearly, I have another job. I have one secretary that I share with six other people in my suite and a $7,000 budget for the year. So clearly there are a bunch of people that I need to hear from to make good decisions about policy. And so that leaves an incredible opportunity for any and everybody to step into this process and be involved. So you don't have to have a particular elected official that you want or a candidate that you want, but you have someone who's already in office who has the ability to impact policy and the quality of your life, and you have the chance, the space, to interact with that elected official and help to create policy that way.
Erin? I just wanted to say, too, that I think this kind of work that we do is a way of being and not a job, and that you can sort of support it by giving money if you work a different type of job mm-hmm. or volunteering your time. I mean, there's so many different things that people can do to get engaged, and if you don't know, you should just ask it. Anyone in this room, I'm sure we could give you a bunch of opportunities.
I know a lot of great candidates who need, you know, political contributions.
My name is Mika, and I'm the founder of a nonprofit organization based in Brooklyn called Young Movement. And basically, my question is, I think, Edward, you touched on this, and it's just about another space. And Alicia talked about organizations, nonprofit organizations that actually fill that void. Like, how do we reach from young people to, like, the politicians? Like, there has to be that organization that does that. And I guess we're trying to do that, Young Movement is. But in terms of space, like, I just want to ask the young people real quick, how many people are on Twitter or on Facebook among you guys? See? Everyone's on there, right? So I just want to quote real quick a quote that I heard a while ago. There's no social movement that's not political. So you guys, we have to go to the social places that these young people are. And Facebook, Twitter, MTV, BET, like these are places that we frequent as young people. And then once we get there, what do? That's when we elevate the conversation and we start saying, all right, what are these people tweeting about? Maybe some are saying, you know, I'm tired of going to school. Why? So we give them a place to actually say what's on their mind, right? If we have shows on MTV, BET that talk about, that give these people the opportunity to speak, it would be amazing how many people would respond. You know what I'm saying? If we talked about education, how many of you would probably call in? Like, I'd think like 50%. Like, he was talking about the education system. You know what I'm saying? So we have to give him a space. And I think it's important that what Edward said about the blogging and all of that, like, we have to continue, like, going to the social networks so we can actually hear from these young people. And then we'll be able to make policy.
And I just want to say one thing really quickly. If you don't think that blogging makes that much of a difference, ask Shirley Sherrod. Shirley Sherrod was an official in the U.S. Agriculture Department who was fired by the Obama administration because of a blogger, a right-wing blogger, took a small excerpt from her speech, put it up on his blog that made her appear as if she was discriminating people, white people, based on their race. And immediately she was fired by the Obama administration. So as you said, all social movements are political, and technology and social networking and the blogosphere is extremely important because elected officials are paying attention to it, whether we believe it or not.
Thank you, Edward. Young lady in the front had a question.
It's not a question, but I want to comment on what you said. I'm sorry to point at you, but I don't know your name.
Kathy Cohen.
Kathy?
Yeah.
Okay. You said something about how the students who are in, like, not the most expensive schools, they don't focus on other things. They focus more on their work. And me and my mother have this conversation a lot. And she feels that I go to Catholic school instead of public. I was in public school for a few years, and then I went to Catholic school like for the rest of my life. And she feels that Catholic school is better. And in some ways it is, in some ways it's not. Because I feel that I go to Aquinas High School, and where I live is Frederick Douglass Academy right there. And she feels that the name of your school helps you get places. And I disagree with her in some ways, because at Frederick Douglass, I have more things that are open to me. And at my school, it's a college preparatory school, and they do tell me to take on my regions, and they help me with my grades and stuff. But I feel that some other schools, and they may be public, they may be chartered, they may be whatever, and they might open me to more things than just my school can. So it could be that, yeah, I go to my school, and the person that goes to that public school, we might graduate the same level, but they might get more than I can because they were open to more. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it doesn't matter what school you came to, it matters on the person, how much they were open to.
Not to go against you, sis, but I go to Rice High School, and I feel like, because she said, like how she said that the name of your school doesn't get you places, but personally speaking, I know some kids that's graduating this year, and they go into top schools in the city. Like a kid from my school last year went to Columbia just because of the name that was put on his application sheet. Just because it said Rice High School. Just because it's Rice. Because... Sorry. But, so, you can't say that because you go to a Catholic school and because that, you know, what you're saying, you know, because I can't really explain it too well, but you can't really say that the public school is open to more. It's just the thing that what the school is pretty much handing you. Because as an example, my school is pretty much handing me a lot more than maybe your school.
The sad reality is that many of our schools aren't functioning the way they should, and there's this mythology about charter schools. Charter schools aren't necessarily better schools. One of the challenges is they take resources from public schools. So I think we would all agree, everybody in this room would agree, that all of our schools could do a better job of offering a wider array of opportunities for our young people. I know we're running really short on time. We have one last question, then we're going to give each of the panelists an opportunity to make a quick closing remark. Okay. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Carla Shedd, and I'm actually an assistant professor of sociology at Columbia, and if I could admit all of you, I would. But my research is also on youth in Chicago, and the question I have is actually relevant to the issue that was just brought up, and I have it for Dr. Cohen, is to think about the sort of decision-making that's happening at 15, at 16, at 17. They're, you know, are having experiences or perhaps making decisions that are changing the entire trajectory of their lives. So if you drop out at 15, it's more likely you're going to go to prison, have interaction with the justice system, et cetera. But my question is about this reconciliation of opportunity and discrimination, which you talk about, and I sort of think of it in terms of opportunity and injustice. And so what does it mean for, like, this young brother to know that he perhaps individually is much better off than kids who are in other schools, but he could be much more incensed about that situation, even if he's not sort of personally impacted by this idea that they're, you know, vicariously impacted. And that goes back to the notion of linked faith that Thomasina brought up. So my question is for political scientists, and to sort of think about the youth and the moment in which these social and very politically formative attitudes are sort of happening at 15, 16, 17, and you're sort of stuck in this moment, but then you have many more experiences. How do you sort of reconcile the good with the bad to sort of think of the lasting formative impact of an interaction with a police officer at 17 and then to be 25 and 30 and 35 and 40? So I want sort of your ideas about the long view of these political snapshots that we're getting at 15 through 25.
I'll be quick, because I know we gotta get, you're like, be really quick. Okay, so very quickly, Carla. One is, I think you're right about many young people that we talked to, for example, overwhelmingly said that young black people were discriminated against much, you know, much more by the police, much more. And then when we ask questions about your own personal experiences with discrimination, those rates were much lower, right? So their own personal experiences were different than the ways in which they understood a broader analysis of the experiences of young black people. So that there's a disjuncture there. Two, I think what we are seeing is that the alienation and exclusion that young people feel at 15, their experiences with the police, whether it's, you know, being harassed or arrested, or their experiences in emergency rooms because, in fact, they don't have private health care, builds on also a socialization that they're experiencing at home that says, you know, don't trust white people, which, you know, it's probably a good thing to teach. No offense to white people here. But, you know, don't trust the police, be careful. You know, racism still exists. And so, in fact, I think it's a repeating narrative that gets kind of embedded in one's thinking about how to understand the world and the society and the state's relationship to black people, and even to you, even though you don't have, even though, for example, you may be now middle class and have a very different relationship to the state, but you will still kind of identify, as Michael Dawson has talked about, with a kind of linked fate sense of how does the state treat kind of the most marginal black people, right? So I think that's why you will see people, for example, of a different class not representing kind of a relationship to the state that you might expect if you only looked at it by class and didn't understand the intersection of race and class in their socialization process. Does that answer your question? Quickly, I'm sorry. Okay.
And one of the things I just wanted to share from some of the young people that I've talked with about this issue, about for the long term, I've been stunned by how many young people don't see themselves making it to 30 or to 25. So they're not thinking about what will happen decades from now, because they just don't, that in their world, that's not, frankly, a probability for many of them, which is beyond sad. Beyond, I mean, that's the crux of what we're talking about here. And I know we have to be out of this room very shortly, so I'm going to ask Edward to start. We're going to give 2 minutes to each of our panelists to close out.
Okay, I'll be very brief. Dr. Cohen is my professor at the University of Chicago, and a lot of times when I make a claim in class, he always says, you need to support it by, you know, quoting something from the book. So, Dr. Cohen, this is for you. I'm going to quote from the book. So, all right. Page 234 says, as a nation and a community, we must renew our commitment to black youth, following their lead as they help us to reconceptualize what constitutes meaningful politics, whose lives are valued, protected, and enriched, and how to produce a moral politics through which all are allowed, encouraged, and provided with the means to be full and equal members of our political community. Everyone in here is powerful beyond measure. If you look at many of the social movements in this country, they have been led by young people and young people of color. Although people may not like what you have to say, if you speak loud enough, if you galvanize the support, if you get together, form coalitions, people will start listening to you, and people will start acting and not just reacting, but forming policies based on the way you feel. You control your decision-making process. Manifest your destiny, speak up, and you have the power to remix democracy. Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
I just want to say that we have to stop being afraid to talk about racism from the top to the bottom. We're doing our young people a disservice. When we have young people reporting that they haven't personally experienced racism, but that racism exists, it's because our inability to talk about and articulate what racism is has trickled down through our families, and now our young people know something's wrong with an experience they just had, but because they can't articulate it, they can't even tell us that they've experienced an incidence of racism. And so we need to stop it, we need to open up the conversation, and just not be afraid to tell the truth.
We have... We have come too far, we can't turn around. We'll flood the streets with justice, we are freedom bound.
I really believe that. You know, I believe that young people have the ability to really change the world. My sons, I have two sons, and I invest a lot of energy in that in that sense in them that they really can do something about the situations that are going on in our communities. And it's sort of up to us to really think through some of these issues. And I do struggle with the systems and the individual and how, who's culpable and who's responsible, and how do we balance that out so that we don't blame people and we look at the larger systems and then we understand that we can fix them and change them. And so I just want to sort of repeat that again. I want to sort of acknowledge that it is a common struggle that we should continue to talk about as a community. And I want to thank OSLI for bringing us here this evening, and thank all of you for coming.
Pretty voice. I think that we have to have a balance between acknowledging those systemic issues that exist and understanding what our role and responsibilities are. I think that this is an unprecedented time for youth leadership. And to the young people in the room, whoever considers themselves young, this is our moment. And I believe that this is our opportunity to decide that if you don't like the circumstances that you're in, you can do something about them. You can make mistakes along the way, but we absolutely have a model, and then we can kind of remix it and do our own thing to decide that the world that we want to see is the one that we can help create. And we don't need to wait for a permission, or as I say, the anointing or the appointing, to make that happen. And thank you to all who helped to put this together. It was an honor to be with you, wonderful, brilliant people.
Before I get my closing statements, it's a pleasure. I was a graduate student at UCLA, and Boundaries of Blackness was one of those books that you put in front of students, and it would set off the discussion sections, and so I really appreciate this. And a lot of folks who are in this room, are still in this room, were led to my own personal development, because I was once a young rabble-rouser. Now I got a tie on because things change, grow up. But I just want to say this to the young black people in the room, especially the y'all that are in high school. You know, I told a story before you guys got here about a young woman I met by the name of Lanisha. When I first met Lanisha, she was singing a song by Lil Boosie. I know this is New York, so it's a little bit different. But the song went, "You don't know my struggle, so you can't feel my hustle. You don't know what I've been through." And the real deal is, the world doesn't care what you've been through. You know, they don't care if your mama's on dope. They don't care if your daddy's a killer. They don't care if you grew up on food stamps. Nobody cares. But you have to care. You have to care more than anybody else cares about y'all. Because if you guys don't do it, I mean, I'm just saying. You know, I'm 32. My son just started toddler school today. You know what I'm saying? I'm grown and old. If y'all do not take your power seriously, if you do not take Facebook seriously, if you do not take Twitter seriously, if you do not take your education seriously, all the progress that has happened over the last 40 years will stop with y'all. But I think y'all have the power to do it.
Okay, I'll be quick, and I'll start by thanking everybody on this panel. I mean, this was just an amazing discussion, and I guess I want to say I hope that what this is about a discussion that we're going to continue, that it is not kind of a one night where we make black youth central, but in fact a serious commitment, and I'll say a moral commitment, to respecting and allowing them to thrive and have amazing lives like they're supposed to do in this country. And that will mean, I think, at times getting out of the way. It will mean at times supporting. It will mean at times challenging, but it has to be a commitment to an engagement with them. And it means, I think, also a different model. And this is no slight on anybody, but not just a leadership model, but an engagement model, that there is a role for every young person. And that we have to recognize and respect their analysis. And the last thing I'll say is, this book started with my nephew, who is no longer a youth, as we would describe them, and it continues because I have a four-year-old who is, my heart. And to believe that, in fact, she has every right that every other child has in this society means that I got to struggle, and we all have to struggle, and that struggle actually has to be led by young people, and I have to respect your leadership, so I thank you for that. So.
So I just want to give the panelists a round of applause again, just thank them. And I want to also thank Thomasina, especially for moderating. She did an excellent job. as they have already said, we're way beyond our time, but I do just want to thank everybody for staying through. We started early and we ended late, so that apologies to everyone, but I think this was a very engaging conversation and worth the while. And so I just want to thank everybody, especially, can we give a round of applause to the young people who came in and took time, because hopefully we didn't cut into their homework time. I just want to thank everybody again. Hopefully we can continue this conversation, because it takes action, not just the words, that we need to see the change in our community. So thank you. And unfortunately, we have to actually ask people to exit, but there's food in the back. You can grab it as you're walking out, and hopefully we'll continue the conversation. Oh, one last note. I want to thank Bakari and Zero Divide, because they provided the handouts for us. So Ruth Williams, the program officer, and that's it. Thank you.